The work of this church in the world is realized through the generous financial support of all who call this place home. Along with the gifts and time and talent, ours is a shared ministry. You have a role to play here. Church membership is open to all. For more information, go to uusf.org.
I don't know what Nancy Willard would call the feeling that she had in the hardware store that she describes in her poem, "A Hardware Store as Proof for the Existence of God," but she definitely was having a moment. In that moment, ordinary things were more momentarily taken out of ordinary focus, weren't they? I mean, hinges are spreading like brass wings. New rakes, she says, shyly fanning their toes, as she puts it. Everything inanimate somehow in that moment is animate, alive with life and possibility and purpose, too. In a world not perfect, but not bad either, she writes, let there be glue, glaze, gum and grabs, caulk also and hooks, shackles, cables and slips, and signs so spare a child may read them. Men, women, in, out, no parking, beware of the dog. In the right hands, they can work wonders. It's an odd, funny moment of connection. She's expanded beyond herself and stepping into larger delight of life, what pulses with life. And it's bigger than it was just a moment before. And all of it is waiting to be of use, as she is, she must realize, all waiting to be of service and to work its wonders in the world. We're all gonna go to, wait, what's that great store in Castro? The Cliffs Variety Store, oh my gosh. That's a place to go after church, to feel all this. Dr. Keltner would probably have called what she feels in that moment or describes one of the many forms of awe. Keltner and other scientists have been trying for the last many decades to name all these feelings we have, what they really are, the function they play in our lives, how we conceive of ourselves when we're caught up in them, and how we relate to the world, maybe differently. And also, after they take hold, what, if anything, remains? Keltner, as some of you may know him, maybe even took a class with him, he went to UC Berkeley to study psychology at a time that a revolution was going on. For so long, the field of psychology and of economics even described human beings as cognitive, functional beings. Economics talked and built its models on human beings being rational decision makers. But were we? Could you understand us by reason alone? It turned out that founding thesis for so much, including the decision sciences that was studied by a friend of mine there at the same time, taught in the academy, was wrong. We human beings are not entirely rational actors making rational decisions in the marketplace or anywhere else. I mean, ask anyone who purchases a depreciating luxury asset whether the decision is rational, and you might hear rationalizations, but nothing like sound economic reasoning. And I know a lot of couples who are happily together for a long time when there were plenty of rational reasons why they should not marry. My mother-in-law gave my husband and I a few just to think about. And she was right to raise them. Studies have shown, in fact, that even when we think we're making decisions based on reason, you and I, we're often making those decisions based more on gut or instinct, and then retroactively finding rational reasons that we can choose the thing we really want to choose. And to some degree, that's fine. Emotions are important guides, right? Our brain, we know, picks up so much information, including emotional cues, micro expressions, things that give us information and inform that gut reaction, as we call it. And knowledge, knowledge of that maybe gives us permission to lean into it sometimes, like the hair going up on the back of your neck sometimes that tells you something before rationally you can process that you have something to worry about. And knowledge we have of things like implicit bias also tells us that we can be conditioned to feel things like distrust or fear or the opposite for reasons that are not at all rationally justifiable or justifiable. Knowledge is power. And in this area that we're talking a little bit about today, the jury isn't really out anymore, I don't think, or the judgment, at least for the moment, is in. We human beings, we're not rational beings, not fully, not even close. It was people like Paul Ekman at Berkeley in his 1972 paper, Emotion in the Human Face, that launched academia into the study of emotions more intensely. And then started people looking at how we might name and describe them, how these things showed up in our bodies, in our brains, in our behavioral choices. Scientists started with the negative ones, like shame and fear and disgust, and then moved later to more positive ones, like gratitude and love and pride. And then more recently, we've been talking about and learning about the feelings and experiences that are harder to get at, like the one we're talking about today, awe. Keltner was among a generation of scientists who was starting this work. He's at Berkeley now. He studied with Ekman. It was Ekman, actually, I think, who planted the seed in Keltner's mind about studying awe very early in Keltner's career. But it was life, decades later, that watered that seed. More particularly, it was Dackner's brother's death. Dackner tells a bit of the story in the book. Dackner's brother, Rolf, was a year younger than Dackner. They were partners, it sounds like, in all of life's adventures. Dackner remembers them doing everything together, skateboarding in Laurel Canyon, where they lived as young children, later hiking and getting lost in the Sierra foothills when their family moved there. Wild trips to Mexico as young adults and dance clubs and being in the best men in each other's weddings. And then, when in his early 50s, Rolf got diagnosed with colon cancer, Dackner was accompanying his brother on this part of the journey. While his brother underwent treatment. But then when the cancer was winning, when he received the call from Rolf, after a morning his brother had spent with his wife and his own children, to find out that Rolf had done as he had planned to do at some point, taken the cocktail of opiates that would allow him to die with dignity and invite his whole family to gather around him as he transitioned from this world to the mystery beyond. Being present for his brother's death, Dackner said, was a profound experience. I sensed a light radiating from Rolf's face, Dackner wrote. It pulsated, touching us as we leaned in with slightly bowed heads. The chatter of my mind faded. I could sense a force around his body pulling him away. And in that moment, a voice in his mind said, I feel awe. All emotions can be hard to define. What exactly is happiness, fear, joy, anxiety. Often we know them by how they show up in our bodies for us or by the kind of moments that invite them to show up, and awe is no different. Keltner tried to describe that moment of awe, what it was like for him. He writes, "My feeling in that overwhelming moment shared some essence with experiences of awe from my past, both big, for example, seeing Nelson Mandela speak after his 27 years of captivity with 50,000 other people, and small, seeing the dusk light on an oak tree, listening to my young daughter's duets of laughter, watching Rolf pass, I felt small, humble, quiet, pure. The boundaries that separated me from the outside world faded. I felt surrounded by something vast and warm. My mind was open, curious, aware, wondering." So Keltner set out to study awe. He teamed up with NYU professor and author Jonathan Haidt to define awe. They immersed themselves in sacred writings, in anthropologists and their accounts of when awe showed up in the cultures and the people's stories that they studied. In a variety of ways, culture talked about and experienced awe across cultures and time, and they decided on this as their definition. Awe is the feeling of being in the presence of something vast that transcends your current understanding of the world. Awe is the feeling of being in the presence of something vast that transcends your current understanding of the world. I'm not entirely sure I agree with that definition. I think awe can be that experience of vastness that transcends our current understanding of the world, and experiences like that that recall us to a vaster understanding of the world and our place in it that we have had in the past. I don't think they always change our understanding of the world, though often they can, but always they recall us to a wisdom that we find easy to lose and forget. Think of Carmen's experience of standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon. How many people have stood on the edge of the Grand Canyon? It is grand. Or on a mountaintop, or at the base of a giant sequoia, or in Muir Woods near the circles of redwoods, or at the ocean, or lying back to take in the wide expanse of blue sky and the clouds sailing across it. And you know, we all know in those moments, experiences that often take us swept up into the vastness of the natural world, right? In grandeur and expanse of it all. Or the first time that you took in, hopefully lying down on your back, hopefully in a place where ambient light was minimal, the expanse of the night, alive with stars, clear and full. Those stars, and maybe you knew when you looked then what a parent or teacher or lover of astronomy told you. Wait, astronomy? Yes, astronomy. you know what I was hoping I hadn't said, yes. Which is that each of those stars is a sun in a distant galaxy so small because it's traveled from so far away, maybe not even there anymore. And all of a sudden, in those moments, looking at the night sky, right? You remember this, I remember this. There's this moment, like those paintings that pop and you see into the depth of them, where you are just thrown out and realize you are clinging by chance and gravity to this small planet spinning in this expanse, and you can't even imagine how big it is, but you can begin to imagine. And it changes your sense of your place in the universe. It literally changes how big you feel. The scale of your life. That is awe, right? Those moments in the presence of trees that have lived for centuries and a canyon etched by icebergs and places that have seen dinosaurs, and you realize what it means to be a small part of something vast beyond imagining. Those aren't the only times and places awe comes. You know this from your own experience. Keltner and another research, Yeonji Bai, also teamed up to look at when and how we feel awe, when we self-report it. Some people were asked to keep daily diaries of awe. It's a great idea, isn't it? Add it to your gratitude diary. Nature was certainly one. What do you think were some other places people felt awe? Childbirth, in birth and death moments and life moments. A child's first steps, in relationship, in relationships, in also in collective moments of relationship, in crowds, dancing at a concert. What did they call it? Ecstatic effervescence is what Emil Durkheim called it. In worship, in marches, music, visual arts. In, yes, here, I think, well, I'll talk about that later, but anyway. Talking to strangers. Dackner says, you've got a bunch of them that he, and some of them the categories are huge, so visual arts can include like the design of a machine sometimes brought people, probably engineers largely who could understand it, but I mean, I don't, you know, I love the beauty of a good watch when I can see how it works. Spiritual and religious experiences of awe. I think that's what you're partly getting at, Dennis. Epiphanies of any kind, right? Those moments where all of a sudden we understand something and there's this transcendence and a sense of connection to something powerful. Stories and experiences of life and death. And there were two more, the collective effervescence, which I love, getting merged in the oceanic we when we're in a big crowd. And the last of the eight ways that people found awe, the way that was most common and most surprising to Dackner, acts of moral beauty. Watching someone act with goodness of intention, exceptional virtue, character, or courage. Reading about lives of great virtue or courage, particularly in the face of suffering or risk. This, it turns out, is actually the slam dunk of awe, if you need it. This is when we're most likely to feel it. And it was written by an academic, not a clergy person, so I just want to underline that. And when we feel awe, my friends, what's most common are those experiences of that moment of vastness, of self-transcendence that happens. It's a self-transcendence that you and I know in our bones as the places, I think, when we have them, that we sort of know we are meant to anchor in a world that sometimes pulls us away from them with its painful myth of individualism that isolates us and cuts us off from that. Awe reorients you and me to our place in the world and all of it, our rightful place and size. It's like seeing our place in the matrix of it all. And it turns out also, one more thing I want you to know before we leave, it turns out also that it reorients our soul. You see, it turns out after you and I feel or experience moments of awe, if we are asked to make choices about how generous to be to others or whether to do the more courageous thing, or we're measured in our compassion for those other than ourselves, even those we consider our enemies. Everything we choose is oriented more toward larger life and love and courage after we have these moments of remembering. Remember the word remembering? It's literally pulling back your limbs back into your body, remembering ourselves. How can you, after all, litter indiscriminately when you see the grandeur of a giant sequoia and stand at its base, unable to reach your arms around it? How can you weigh convenience more than the calling of the redwoods to care for the earth, those who have stood, these towering elders, protective and majestic, and a monument to nature's beauty and power and possibility? And how can we be petty and parsimonious, lock the door and forget those who deserve care and medicine and peace and a chance to flourish, when we have watched a journalist stand among the rubble and in the midst of sirens to tell the story that needs to be told? Or read the life of Nelson Mandela, or Gandhi, or watch stumble upon a young teenager who steps in between an elderly man and someone who is threatening them on the street, and see the fear and determination in that face, and know the courage and the love for a stranger that in that moment is incarnate and unapologetic. Awe is medicine, it turns out. That's what Keltner discovered with scientific methods and tools after he had a glimpse of it in the moment around his brother's death and the ways he found to heal in the months and years afterwards. It's what art has known. It's what music and musicians have known. It's what religion has known in the building of its cathedrals and organs that shake your bones and sacred dance and the stories we tell of moral courage and gathering in collective witness to sing and to hold one another's hands and to pray together. It's what we all know apparently 2 to 3 times a day if we're paying attention and keeping a journal, in hardware stores even. And knowing what it does for us, you and I might consider being intentional about it, about making sure we get ourselves some, standing and breathing with it when it stumbles upon us or we upon it on Hyde and Turk or any other corner of our lives. Enough to connect to the vastness and hang on and feel the anchor dropping again where it needs to be as we navigate through the storms of this world and direct our souls through to what is true and beautiful and good again, and right size ourselves so we can serve larger life, which is the point. Find awe. Keltner heard in the days after his brother's death. Find awe was the voice in his head and his heart as he felt completely bereft. Find awe. May we do the same. Amen.
Awe is a little big word. Rather complex, describing almost more of a vibration. When I lived in Nicaragua, there was an icebreaker we would use with groups. It had little to do with what one said, but more with how we'd say it. So we'd be in a circle and we'd turn to a person and we'd say, 2, 3, 4. And they'd look back, 896? Or, 1958. Oh no, 2016. And then ah was the sound I would say when my mother had me open wide my mouth and stick out my tongue to look at my tonsils when I came to her complaining of a sore throat.
Ah.
And then I got a little more serious on topic. The feeling of awe. Though it's not a word I commonly use, I did begin to remember. I think of the deep orange, red-colored sky at dusk with silhouettes of the birch trees as I looked out my mother's window in Minnesota that was punctuated by the white snow-covered ground. It's breathtakingly beautiful. Or when I was 22 and volunteering in Venezuela, it was the Monday ritual to drive to the beach, a 2.5-hour ride on a seemingly endless, windy and curvy road. And then, pow, suddenly we burst from the tree-filled tunnel, and there before us was the vast Caribbean. Blue, green, lapping. And I was awestruck. I had never seen the ocean. Such beauty. The blues and the greens of the water were exquisite. And then Sam, my friend and partner in foolery, likes to tease me about my utterance when I walked up to the ridge of the Grand Canyon for the first time and simply said as I stood before it, "I see why they call it grand." Standing before the Grand Canyon, before the beauty of oceans and sunsets, there is that feeling of awe that takes over all of my senses, releasing that deep breath. And there is a kind of joy, a kind of all-body smile, may I even say, a feeling of love, sometimes at first sight, and sometimes slowly rising up from the tips of the toes to the crown of my head. And when I got to that place, that visceral feeling inside of me, the sometimes overwhelming and emotional place, I suddenly imagined standing on the sidewalk outside of our faithful fool's home in the Tenderloin, that place just a 10-minute walk down the hill from here, that people are cautioned to stay away from. That place where we often dehumanize the people and the headlines make it sound like a dangerous place. I got the image of me, our fool's team, all of us, standing at the corner of Turk and Hyde and looking around, not in fear or doom, but in awe. As we stand at the corner, we look up towards the sky and we see this large, beautifully painted mural, 6-story high, with hummingbirds and flowers overlooking the children's park, where kids are running around on safe, brightly colored structures and laughing. I turn around and I see the beautiful Rivers to Sky mural, with Billie Holiday and Miles Davis on the wall of the building adjacent to the Fool's building. A beautiful picture of history commemorating the Black Hawk Jazz Club and a welcoming space for people to sit. It's called the Oasis. And just beyond that is a beautiful mural painted by Christopher Birch of a cosmic black person that he painted in hopes of inspiring, educating, and provoking black beauty. And then there's the people, the mosaic of languages and cultures and breathtaking resilience. So many people from so many parts of the world including their homeland of San Francisco. I wondered, how would I and you and the neighbors and the neighborhood be changed if we all gathered at the corner of Turk and Hyde and looked up and down and all around, enveloped in a feeling of awe and smile. Our reading this morning is titled, A Hardware Store as Proof of the Existence of God, by Nancy Willard. I praise the brightness of hammers pointing east, like the steel woodpeckers of the future, and dozens of hinges opening brass wings, and six new rakes shyly fanning their toes, and bins of hooks glittering into bees, and a rack of wrenches like the long bones of horses, and mailboxes sewing rows of silver chapels, and a company of plungers waiting for God to claim their thin legs in their big shoes and put them on and walk away laughing. In a world not perfect, but not bad either, let there be glue, glaze, gum, and grabs, caulk also, and hooks, shackles, cables, and slips, and signs so spare a child may read them, men, women, in, out, no parking, beware the dog, in the right hands, they can work wonders.